This is WMUK. I'm Cara Laurence with a preview of an upcoming concert at the Gilmore International Keyboard Festival. Born in Croatia, raised in Salzburg, Austria, and joining me today from his home city of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, Dejan Lasic performs on Sunday, May 1st at the Gilmore International Keyboard Festival. And Mr. Lasic, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today about your program.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
I think it's fascinating that based on just what I said in this introduction, you must have a working knowledge of at least four spoken languages. Are you the kind of person we call a citizen of the world? Do you feel like that sometimes?
Well, you know, I sort of do, because I've lived in Croatia only in the first 12 years of my life. And then I met my both teachers, Zoltan Kocsis and Imre Roman, at the Bartok Festival in Hungary. It was a wonderful festival where I every summer went, you know, when I was a kid, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And Imre Roman at that time taught at the Mozarteum in Salzburg. So I started taking lessons there. And I had to learn German. I already, you know, learned English in school. And I had a little bit of Italian on the side. So, you know, Europe is small, and you move a few kilometers to one direction and there's another country, another language. So, yeah, in a way, it's a great thing, you know, and that way you learn so many wonderful languages and their cultures and, you know, books reading in German by German authors. That is something completely different rather than having a Croatian translation. So I'd like to see myself now living in Amsterdam, you know, a wonderful, open, cosmopolitan city, sort mm-hmm. of as a citizen of the world, yeah.
I think you can apply some metaphor or analogy of speaking many languages to the fact that music itself has many languages, many time periods, many styles from which to choose and to blend together. And I think you are especially apt at this, looking at the series you created called the Liaisons series. Would you tell our listeners what this is about?
Oh, yeah, you know, I was always fascinated by, you know, our unique language, music, having so many different styles, you know, in the course of a period of maybe only a few hundred years. And I was always attracted to the idea of combining different styles, you know, not only on CDs, but in concert programs, where I could sort of experiment together with the audience, you know, and see how one or another composer plays after a particular composer from a different style, different period. And you sort of hear things better. You listen with different ears. Once you are, you know, presenting to the audience, now if I compare it to the program I'm going to play at the festival, works by Scarlatti, and then you jump 200 years later or so to Bartok, you might, you know, at first glance think those two composers have nothing in common. But then, you know, if you scratch beneath the surface and you analyze what actually combines them, you learn that, for instance, we know of Béla Bartok being, you know, a musical nomad. He was investigating and he was composing in so many different styles, languages of other groups, national groups, not only Hungarian, but also Romanian, Serb, Slovak, Arab songs he adapted for, not only piano works, but some of the orchestral works and chamber music works as well. So the same, exact same thing I found out is what Scarlatti did. We think of Scarlatti as an Italian composer, but he wrote all his 555 sonatas, keyboard sonatas, in Spain for Queen of Spain, and they are heavily influenced by folklore of Spanish gypsies, by the flamenco, you know. So this is maybe the folklore is here, the common line, something that combines both of them, Scarlatti and Bartók. And then we know Bartók's son, Peter, he edited many of Scarlatti's sonatas. And Béla Bartók himself loved performing Scarlatti in concert. And so then you learn as you go. Actually, there's so much these two composers have in common, you know, sometimes more than we think. And it's not necessarily that Mozart and Haydn have more in common, or Ravel and Debussy, just because they lived in the same period, in the same country. And this is what fascinated me and made me, you know, start thinking, well, what could work, you know, stylistically and pianistically, because there are so many different techniques over the course of years, and piano made such an amazing progress. You know, I mean, from the harpsichord to the modern piano, it's actually also only 200 years, span of 200 years, and we have so many amazing composers, pianists. So all of that played a, you know, major role for me.
Well, there's something else about this program. After a long day of rehearsing and practice, do you go out in Amsterdam and dance the night away? Are you cutting it up on the dance floor? Because I'm seeing a lot of dancing here.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Not a dance, as King's Day is coming, you know, slowly approaching, and it'll be different kind of dancing. But yes, that is also very important, dance. This is what connects also Scarlatti and Bartók. And if we go, you know, to Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach and Britten, there we have something more of a form that connects them. Because also stylistically, sometimes you listen to late compositions of Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, and they don't sound as they were written by a composer who lived in the 18th century. You know, they sound so ahead of his time. It could be early Schumann or even late Haydn. And when you listen to young Benjamin Britten, who was so influenced by Mozart, we hear there sort of as if Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach gave something to Benjamin Britten to take over stylistically, you know, formally. We have this Sturm und Drang Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, and this incredibly emotionally driven music. It doesn't necessarily fit to the period of Baroque or Rococo or Viennese classics. These were 20 or 30 years of pure emotionalism and drama. And then we have this very formal, very, well, I wouldn't maybe say square, but you know, very thought through compositions by Benjamin Britten, who although was writing them in a, you know, 20th century where one could, you know, do whatever one wanted stylistically and formally, still loved to compose in a style or in the form of the old masters. And there we have this Holiday Diary suite, which already it says in the name suite is something that one wrote in the Baroque period. So that's what I found fascinating, you know, back to the roots, so to speak.
The place where we can find a lot of your music, other liaisons programs such as Scarlatti Bartók, Schumann Brahms, and the CPE Bach in Britten, is a label called Channel Classics. It's based in the Netherlands, is that right?
That's right, yes.
How long have you been associated with this studio and putting some of these programs in recordings?
Oh, yeah, I've started a recording for them in, 98, 99. And it's been going on for 15 years, and we made a number of different recordings, chamber music, solo, also with orchestras and so on. And now I am no longer exclusive with them, so I'm also recording for other labels. And recently I just released the Beethoven's Triple Concerto, because this was another piece and its form that I found really so interesting. And, a piano trio, a symphony, and instrumental concerto all combined in one piece. So this has been now recently out, but that was for Sony Classical. And, it is very interesting with the recording industry and how current developments and changes influence programming, and how much an artist can actually, have the freedom to program interesting programs, and something that interested me and so on. I always, found a priority rather than to, another, I would say mainstream recording. I was pretty lucky so far, really, to sort of combine both something that is interesting to the audiences and to listeners, and so I could make another recording and another, and so far there are 15 plus or so. And
15. I've only explored about 5 of them, and I must say that the variety is great, and the playing is just beautiful.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because it's really interesting in our day and time. You can really reach so many people instantly, and I'm not that old, but still I remember, I started playing when I was really young. I mean, I started concertizing when I was 10 or 11, and I was traveling and so on, and I made a first LP, and it was like some LP recording and a CD and a cassette, so I did all three. And, it's nothing to be compared to iTunes nowadays, and Spotify, and all these digital platforms where you could reach people in Korea and Australia instantly, and share your thoughts, and digital booklets where you can even write your own texts and what you intended with this recording and so on. So it's absolutely opened so many doors. So that's really great. And with that, you support your concerts, and it goes hand in hand, concerts and the recordings. So that's,
absolutely,
that's great.
I will buy a CD to remind myself of a very special concert evening,
Yes.
You are a very experienced concert performer. What will you do when you arrive in Kalamazoo and first arrive at Stetson Chapel, the hall where you'll play? What are some of the things on your checklist to go through to prepare for a live performance in a brand new place and a brand new instrument?
Mm-hmm. It's really brand new. I'm really looking forward to this performance, because it's my first time. It's debut in Kalamazoo for me at the festival. I've been many times in the U.S. and somehow never made it over to Gilmore Festival. So I'm really looking forward to that. And, you immediately see the atmosphere, the team. Of course, piano, let's not forget. The most important thing, of course, is the piano. How not necessarily just how the instrument feels and plays, but also in the environment, in the hall, because same instrument sounds, of course, differently in two different environments, halls. So this is very important. And then just go from there. I've learned over the years that too much planning what will happen in this particular acoustics or with that particular instrument is not really so helpful, because there are so many aspects that just come with the audience, with the performance, and this is the beauty about the thing what we do. This is why I'm one of these optimists who I mean, I don't believe that classical music life is decreasing. I actually see that in Germany and in the U.S., although there are, of course, some difficulties and many orchestras face difficulties, there's still so much interest by audiences, you know, and by students to learn instruments, to go to the concerts. And you can feel those slight differences in from city to city, from country to country. And this is what makes it special, you know. You can feel if the audience is really being attentive or just listening or, you know, playing along. So all these little things that travel through the airwaves that you can't see or feel or touch, but they're there. That's what eventually makes for the experience. So yeah, really looking forward.
And a certain amount of confidence in your own ability to adapt and to bring the audience with you. Yes.
Sure. Yeah, that's of course a big part of it. And we really communicate, performing artists. You know, we need to, I wouldn't say defend, but sort of show the greatness of the score of Scarlatti or Bartok or Bach or Britten, you know, as if it's been never heard before. And this is for me, because I write my own music, you know, this is what I would expect from a performer to make my music be better than it actually is, you know what I'm saying. So it's really very important how the performer plays your piece, because it's been, you know, proven throughout history, you know, in the past century, some of the greatest pieces were not that well received. Sometimes, audiences weren't ready for something completely new. Sometimes performers didn't really deliver, you know, a performance that would satisfy the composer. And so it's really very important to, to be sort of self-assured and know what you're doing, but also a healthy portion of doubt, you know, and improvisation, something that one can see when there's a jazz musician, you know, coming on stage. He or she, they don't really know exactly what they're going to do. You know, we'll see throughout the night where it will go, and then you see how audience reacts after the first piece, and you sort of have to go from there. So not everything can be planned, and that's great.
Well, finally, Mr. Lasic, if you were able to stay within 2 days of your concert, you have the choice of seeing jazz legend Kenny Barron and his trio, or you could go see mezzo-soprano Susan Graham sing a recital of songs with Bradley Moore.
Wow.
Or you could go see Jeremy Danks' solo recital, and I think he's playing some of the same composers as you. So which one would you pick?
Oh, my God. I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that. Which one? No, I haven't. You know, I'm glad I have to go to New York immediately after my concert, because this is really a tough choice. I really don't know. I would maybe go to the first half of one and then to the jazz session, because I really love jazz. You know, I'm very often in jazz clubs, and I probably have more jazz CDs at home than classical. So this is really a tough choice. I probably would make a mixture for all three. So I'm in a way relieved I can't stay for longer.
Well, that brings us back to being a citizen of the world. And I want to thank you, Dejan, for talking to me today. And we really look forward to your debut at the Gilmour International Keyboard Festival in Kalamazoo. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to talk to you. Thanks.